accession number 20600, reel 1.
Ray Russell, reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Birmingham, on 16th of October 1920.
Can you tell me something about your family background, please? Did both of your parents come from Birmingham?
No, they came from Kent, Broadstairs in Kent, actually, but for some reason or other, my parents were in the Birmingham area at the time of my birth. So I was born there because I wanted to be near my mother at the time.
Had your father moved to Birmingham because of work?
I think he was there on business for a short time.
What line was he in?
Several interests, but he was, I suppose his principal business was furniture manufacturing.
Was he an employer?
Yes.
How many people did he employ?
Really no idea. I would suspect about 30 or 40 at the time, but I don't really know. The business was conducted in the city somewhere, near Finsbury Park, as much of the furniture industry was in those days.
Did you go to school in Birmingham?
No, we were only in Birmingham for a short time. Then we moved back to Broadstairs. And I went to school at Chatham House in Ramsgate.
How old were you when you left there?
16.
So that was 36. Mm. Did you get a job?
Yes. For a short time I worked in Broadstairs in my father's business, which he also had a cinema down there, and I worked as a projectionist for a while because a relative had very good contacts with the Chrysler Corporation in America. In fact, he was a personal friend of Walter Chrysler, the car manufacturer, and he wanted me to go in his business in London. And eventually, in 1937, I think it was, by then my father had died, and my mother and I moved to London, and I went to work for this company, which was the main distributor for Chrysler cars in London. The intention being that I would go to America and work in the American offices of the Chrysler Corporation sometime in 1940. Well, for obvious reasons, that never occurred. 1939, things changed a lot, and for a short time, I did actually volunteer to join the Air Force as soon as war started. But at that time, they were a bit fussy about who they took on and how many people they needed. And so I became a cinema projectionist for about 12 months and then eventually joined the Air Force in April 1941.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
Well, I was at home and we heard it on the radio. At that time I was living in St. John's Wood. And almost immediately the air raid sirens went. I do remember that. We had a basement. My mother and I went down there, waiting for something to happen. Eventually, of course, the all clear sounded.
How did you feel about the news that England was at war?
Hard to remember. I would have been, 18 or nearly 19 at the time. I don't know. I don't know whether I expected as to be involved in the war or not, but I think as we got closer to the September the 3rd, it became inevitable, and probably then expected H.G. Wells, that film, to take effect.
The War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds.
Did the war affect?
No, it wasn't the War of the Worlds, was it?
Was it something else?
The War of the Worlds was about the Martian thing. No, this was the film.
Don't mind, anyway.
Anyway, I've got the...
You expected air attack, anyway.
That's right, yes. And it so did everybody else.
Did the war affect you in the early part of the war?
Yes, again, it affected me, in as much as my prospects of joining the Chrysler Corporation were now virtually nil. And obviously, as I say, I became temporarily as a projectionist in the Odeon at Woolwich, where I had a grandstand view of all the original, the first night of the Blitz and everything else that took part.
Can you give me all the details you can remember of what you saw of the bombing, especially that first
day? Being in Woolwich, being in the cinema there, which was quite a tall building, from the upper levels you could see right across the docks. You see the bombs and the fires. And obviously they went off for hours. Seemed to be non-stop. Curiously enough, very little happened south of the river that I remember, even though we had Woolwich Arsenal there.
Did no bombs fall in your vicinity then?
They must have done. I think there were some bombs in the area. And then, of course, subsequently, during the next few months, between September 40 and April 41, when I was still in Woolwich, we had many raids and a fair number of near misses.
Can you describe any near misses that you had?
Well, yes, I suppose going home and hearing a bomb coming down and diving under cover under the nearest doorway or something and hear a bomb go off and all the debris coming down and so on. There was another night when I was actually still in the cinema and there was an aerial mine went off, which actually hit the tax office at Woolwich, for which we were all grateful. And I remember the blast of that coming right through the building, blowing all the doors open, and I think it sort of knocked me against the wall as well, even though this was some half a mile away. Another occasion, walking home after a raid in the morning, coming across a group of people looking down the hole, asking what they were looking at. They said there's an unexploded bomb down there, so I decided not to join them. Quite incredible, really. People would be so curious to look down the hole to see if there was an unexploded bomb. There we are. Tram lines standing up on end on the road somewhere in the Plumstead area.
How did public morale hold up in the bombing?
Well, in those few months, and certainly south of the Thames, it seemed to be quite reasonable. I didn't experience the so-called loss of morale in East London, and I think there was a will to fight back, actually, from the people that I came across anyway. But mind you, I was only subject to it for about 6 months. So.
What was the attitude towards the German aircrews who were carrying out the bombing?
Public attitude. I don't remember many comments at all about it. I just assumed they were the enemy and that they would be there to inflict damage on us. I mean, I accepted the fact that they were the enemy. I didn't have any particular hard feelings about the individual pilots. I just had the usual feelings about an enemy.
Did you feel the Germans might win the war?
I don't think it really crossed my mind, although at the time of Dunkirk, of course, it was there was some doubt. But again, you have to bear in mind that with hindsight, it's easy to say, no, we always had confidence. I don't really remember whether we did have confidence or not. Most of the information we derived was probably from newsreels, which always put on the brighter side of life. And so I suspect we were given a fairly optimistic view of things, even though it was serious.
Did you have problems travelling about during the Blitz?
Oh, yes. Transport was often disrupted. I had to use public transport, which would be either trolley buses or trams. And very often they would be, particularly the trams, would have problems with craters on the line, therefore the trams couldn't travel, or the lines would be, the overhead wires would be down, or the underground conductors would be damaged. And at night time, of course, the cars had very, very poor lighting. They had their very restricted lighting, so.
What was your address during the Blitz?
I was in Abbey Wood, number number three, some road in Abbey Wood.
Did any bombs fall around that
street? Oh yes, yes, quite a few. And we had some fire bombs too, incendiary bombs in the street. Fortunately, my house wasn't damaged other than the windows being broken.
Did you listen to wireless at this time?
Oh yes.
What would you listen to?
Well, obviously the news broadcasts, and just whatever entertainment was on there, I imagine. Probably Tommy Handley. Workers, what was it, music for, new music for the workers, that sort of thing, you know. Workers, playtime or something.
Were there any particular personalities whose voices you would listen to at that time?
Not that I remember. Not that I remember.
Did you listen to Churchill's speeches?
Yes.
What effect did they have?
I think they were stimulating. They were obviously created confidence, I suppose, and hope.
And Haw-Haw?
I never heard him. I never heard him. I heard of him. I heard recordings of him, but I never actually heard the transmissions.
Did you use shelters during the Blitz?
We had an Anderson shelter at home, which I think I used two or three times, possibly. Otherwise, no. No.
When you say at home, you mean in St. John's Wood?
No, sorry, in Abbey Wood. Yes, because when the war started and I took this temporary job at Woolwich, my mother then also moved over to South East London, in Abbey Wood.
Any sight of the Battle of Britain and its
Yes, quite a lot of that, yes. On particularly one Sunday, I remember travelling or walking to work, I think, and above you could see all the contrails and all the aircraft. Hardly see the aircraft, but you could certainly see the contrails and the occasional parachute. So those were quite exciting times in that sense. But again, somewhat remote up there, a long way up.
Can you go through what happened to you once you joined up, please?
Yes, when I joined, I first went to Cardington, the RAF site at Cardington, where we were kitted out and learned, I suppose, some of the very basic disciplines of the service. Then 3 or 4 days later went to Skegness on the East Coast for basic training consisting of marching and various other disciplinary actions.
How did you take to RAF discipline?
I quite enjoyed it, actually. It was, I suppose the biggest shock was the communal life initially of being in a hut or somewhere with maybe 30 or 40 or 50 other people for the first time, and the loss of privacy and taking showers with other people and so on, which I hadn't encountered before. So that was, the thing I remember most. But I quite enjoyed the RAF life and the marching and everything else.
And after Skegness?
Then I went on a training course at Dagenham. I think it was called the South East Essex Technical College. And that was training for radio training as a radio mechanic. The reason I'd been selected for that trade was that my hobby had been that of a radio amateur. Not as a transmitter, but as a building radio receivers and so on for some years. And so the the training took place in Dagenham. I don't know how long it lasted. Yeah, what I do remember is that we were in civilian billets, and as a result of the children in my house getting chickenpox, I hadn't had it, so I then contracted chickenpox and went to a civilian hospital at Chigwell Isolation Hospital for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks possibly, whilst I recovered. As I was the only airman in what was otherwise a children's hospital, I was well treated by all the nurses and the staff. Then I went back to the course, having skipped one level, went back to the course and completed that, I think, successfully. Then went on to a further course at Cranwell in Lincolnshire, which was the first time I think I disliked the RAF, of course. It was such a bleak, cold place. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's, you know, anyone who's been there never wants to go back. And the accommodation was fairly primitive, and there were, of course, thousands of us there, so facilities were overstretched. The food was awful. But eventually I completed the course successfully.
Did they teach you much new in this sphere in Dagenham and Cranwell?
Well, I learnt all the theory, I suppose, correctly, where I'd been a bit sketchy on it before. Learned the theory more correctly and to a more advanced level. At the end of the course in Cranwell, they told me I was going to be retained there as an instructor, acting corporal instructor, which horrified me in view of my attitude towards Cranwell at the time. But for some reason or other, I don't know why, whether it was because of my attitude or what, they then decided I would be sent to 80 Wing at Radlett. I didn't even know where Radlett was at the time, or what 80 Wing was, and no one could tell me. But eventually I arrived there, and found to my surprise it was not an RAF camp at all. It was in fact a large hotel which had been requisitioned by the RAF, which was an admin headquarters, and half a mile away a large house which had been a golf club, which was the operational headquarters, and I was stationed there at the operational headquarters in the receiver workshops, where we used to repair equipment, modify equipment, or in some cases build prototype equipment.
What was this equipment?
Radio, purely. Radio countermeasures equipment. Mostly manufactured to GPO standards. Manufactured by Plessy in Ilford. That would be the meekening equipment. Then we also had American receivers, helicrafters mostly, and HROs, which were far more advanced than anything we had in the RAF, but to entirely different standards.
Can we say at this stage what meekening was?
Yes, the meekening was, in fact, the term given to the masking of enemy beacons. The enemy were using beacons for navigation. They would have two beacons in France, separated by several hundred miles, and the navigators in the enemy aircraft would take fixes on these, and where they reached the critical point where their navigation told them would be the target, that's where they would know they're in the target area. Approximately correct, not terribly accurate because it was medium frequencies. Now, we could have just jammed that, but the point is that the original signals, if you put any form of code in them, jamming alone wouldn't cover that. So what we would do would be to actually receive the signals on the receiver site, complete with all the modulation in them, so the identical signal was then passed through to a transmitter site which would be between 5 and 8 miles away and retransmitted. So that from the point of view of the aircrew receiving the signal, this would be identical, and whatever was done by the Germans to modulate or in any way encode their beacons, we would be radiating the identical signal. It was their signal being re-radiated. This, of course, meant that they now lost their navigational sites, if you like, of the beacons. So they really became useless. This led to either the bombs being dropped in completely different places or the aircraft becoming lost. There were several instances of aircraft actually landing in the UK, thinking they were back in France. Fairly well-documented cases.
How much of this did you know at the time?
The beaconing I knew fairly well, but there were many other operations we carried out which I only knew by the code names. Aspirin was one, bromide. These were countermeasures to various German. They were genuine beams. They were countermeasures for genuine beams. The first one was nicobine, which were two high frequency beams. And the aircraft would fly along the beams, and they'd have, if they were in the centre of the beam, it would be a continuous note. If they veered to one side, it would be, they'd hear dots. The other side, they'd hear dashes. This was an extension of the Lorentz landing beams, which had been used by many countries before the war, but never, of course, at high power and long range. It had originally been a means of landing an aircraft by telling it whether it's left or right of the runway, which was on the centre, where the two beams crossed, where they could hear both. In this case, it would be, as far as I remember, you'd have one which was probably a continuous note and dots, and the other one big dashes, or where the two beams merged with some form where they, when they heard the particular note change, that would be the more precise indication of the bombing location. Those were mostly countered by pure jamming, and these jamming stations were all over the country.
But at the time, you knew such code words as aspirin and bromide.
And many others, yes. Mm. I can give you some more, actually.
Well, yeah. Just go from memory okay. for the moment. We can look at the documents later. But at first, you were put on to radio repair work at Radlett.
Mm.
What date did you reach Radlett, do you think? Approximately?
Either be the end of 1941 or beginning of 1942.
And who were you working under at first? Who was in charge of you?
Well, our workshop, receiver workshop, actually reported to the sergeant in the transmitter workshop, and his name was Smith, Sergeant Smith. In my particular workshop, there were six of us. I remember the names of them. They were, one was Harry Johnson, Len Leeson, Johnny Sweetman, Alan Bell, and Ron Ross.
And you were all doing similar type of work?
That's right, in that workshop.
How long did this first job go on for?
Mine went on till 1943. In February 43, I was in the local cinema one evening, and a slide came on the screen. Well, Corporal Russell reported to the duty officer. I didn't know what I'd done, but I reported to the duty officer to be told I was going to North Africa. No, to told I'd be going overseas. He didn't tell me where I was going, but I happened to know because I had been involved in preparing the equipment to go to North Africa. And unfortunately, this was a last-minute decision to send me. And he said I would have my embarkation leave starting the following day and finishing the following day. So my embarkation leave was something like 12 hours, which just enabled me to run home and get rid of any surplus equipment then report back to the embarkation centre in Cheshire. A well-known one, which I can't remember now.
Before we go on to your journey to North Africa, did the Germans ever attempt to bomb Radlett area?
No, not at all. No, I don't think they were aware of it. Certainly we didn't have any local... There might have been a few accidental stray bombs in the area, but not that I recollect. Surprising, really, because just a few, well, about a mile and a half up the road, were the Handy Page Works, where they built Halifax bombers with an airfield. But even that wasn't attacked, as far as I remember.
And whilst you were at Radlett, did you just stay at that headquarters, or did you move about?
No, I visited a few locations around the country doing repair work. I can't remember where they all were now. Certainly one was Honiton, and some in Norfolk, doing on-site repairs. Also, in some instances, installing some new equipment. So that was...
Any incidents that happened to you at Radlett that we can record, or changes of work?
Radlett, no, that was a fairly easy life, for which I still have a conscience, compared with what other people in the Air Force were doing. We were in civilian billets there, which made life a lot easier. We had reasonable food in the canteen there. And whilst there was discipline, it wasn't the rigid discipline of an RAF camp. So it was, life was relatively enjoyable. It was on the main line to London, so we could get to, if we had weekend leave, we could get to London. It was quite easy. I think we had, I found it interesting because we did have various bits of snippets of information from various people about what was going on, not the overall picture, but the occasional bit of information we would need to know in order to carry out one particular job. So it all became a bit more interesting in that sense, that we were learning a bit more about what we were doing.
Which particular individuals gave you these snippets?
They would be mostly, I think, officers from the operations room who would have to come and brief us on a particular job to do. Otherwise we wouldn't have known quite... I mean, we wouldn't be given the whole story, but we would at least know a little bit about why we had to do something.
Did you ever get any VIP visits to Radlett?
Well, if we did, I don't remember them, or they wouldn't have come across me anyway. The first officer in charge there was, commanding officer was Wing Commander Addison, later Group Captain Addison, and then Group Captain Jones. They were the two senior people. We were also then made part of 100 Group, Bomber Command 100 Group. And a lot of the 100 Group control, I think, was based at Radlett initially, although it was transferred later to Norfolk.
So you said that you went to this transit place in Cheshire?
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, I boarded the troop ship. A troop ship with a Dutch name, as it had been a Dutch cruise liner before the war. I remember going past Northern Ireland on March the 13th, which I think was St. Patrick's Day. We steamed across the Atlantic, going due west. I think probably a day or so. Then we turned to port and went due south, straight down to a level with Gibraltar, and then turned and went due east. Not many incidents on the way. I don't remember any incidents on the Atlantic. However, the night before we landed in Algeria, there was an attack, and one troop ship, the Windsor Castle, was sunk. So when we woke up in the morning, when we went on deck in the morning, one ship was missing. That was just the night before. before we landed. Landed at Algiers. Beautiful sight, all these white buildings on a green background.
Had you gone with comrades from your wing?
Yes, they were from the wing. There would be about probably about 60 of us, but I wouldn't have known any of them because I was from HQ and they came from the various outstations.